Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing conversations about the cultures of consciousness. What powers does the mind have? Of course, it's an ancient question, but one that we continue to struggle with. And I think you could say that on one side of the picture, for those who find that the mind does have power, you got this sort of new age extreme, let's say, where you create your own reality. If you just learn how to use that power to line yourself up right, get your desires focused, get your affirmations polished, tune in with the forces of the cosmos, then you can manifest your dreams. And this sort of extreme view trickles down and manifests itself in any number of ways, down to boardroom conversations, business seminars, ordinary forms of persuasion and self-gratification. And at the same time, as we plunge further into our neuroscientific century, where things are only going to get more and more peculiar with not only discoveries about the brain, but increasingly vexed philosophical questions about how we relate to our brains, if we are our brains, if we aren't our brains, and even if we are our brains, why does it feel like I'm sort of a little bit outside of my brain? And all those questions we wrestle with, and some neuroscientists are starting to tell us that forms of thinking, positive thinking, mental habits of attention, actually change the physical structure of our brain, which on one hand makes sense. You know, you do certain things and certain things happen. But on another hand, it's actually kind of peculiar because all you're really doing is pushing your mind in a certain direction. And why does that actually make a change in the physical stratum of the brain? Is that mind over matter? Are we actually saying something that supports the New Age view, at least to a certain degree? Well, luckily, today we're going to have someone to help guide us through these questions, Mitch Horowitz. We've had him on the show before. He's the author of the new book, One Simple Idea, How Positive Thinking Reshaped Modern Life. And he approaches these questions in one of my favorite ways, as listeners to the show know, which is through history and showing how these ideas developed, and particularly the role that America and American religion played in developing notions about positive thinking, about mind over matter, about the sort of New Age vision of creating your own reality, although this New Age goes back long enough in history that it really must be categorized as an old age at this point. And so I'm very much looking forward to our conversation. But before we bring Mitch on, we, of course, need to introduce the co-host here on Expanding Mind, Maja Daou. Maja also wrote a book about similar material, Sources of the Secret. And so I'm sure she's going to have a lot to say today. So how are you doing, Maja? Are you feeling positive? Is your thinking positive today?
Well, I'll tell you, this is my two cents, which I'll try to fit into a single paragraph on the matter of positive and negative thinking and the whole New Age to duty. What never ceases to amaze me is that people can accept and feel and think and experience that their thoughts and thinking one way or the other can affect their reality and possibly change the world, if that's what they're accepting. And what never ceases to amaze me is that they're comfortable to stop there. Like, they're like, oh, my thinking changes the world. Cool, I'll just think positively. And they can't get past that and be like, wait a minute, my thinking changes the world. What are the implications of that? What does that mean in terms of what reality is and what human beings are and what our capabilities are? So I feel like in a lot of these debates people get into about this subject matter, they're missing the moon for the finger. If there are implications in that direction and all these people subscribe to them or have, you know, beliefs like Mitch points out, then why do they limit their beliefs to stopping there instead of just realizing, oh my God, what does that even mean, like, for us, you know?
Well, Mitch does a great job at the end of his book of assessing various ways of thinking about these claims and their implications, and so we'll look forward to that. But first, we'll bring him on to the show. Mitch, welcome back to Expanding Mind.
Thanks, guys. Great to be here, as always. Hello to you both.
Yeah, good stuff. Congrats on the book. And once
Thank you.
I appreciate your work of archaeology, of digging out some fascinating characters in American religion, and particularly with the New Thought tradition, which is something that, you know, people still don't know about as much as they should, especially given how influential this sort of current of American spirituality has been in terms of positive thinking, the New Age, even, like I mentioned, these sort of, you know, business self-help seminars and things.
Yes.
So can you want to talk a little bit about sort of how you found yourself kind of once again drawn to this current in American in history, and how you've come to, I mean, clearly you think it's very worthwhile because you've done so much work on it. So what's in New Thought for you?
Well, it's interesting. There were two things that drew me to it. One was a matter of history, and another was a deeply intimate personal search of my own. Historically, when I was writing my first book, Occult America, I came to realize that all the various occult and esoteric movements that either grew to prominence in America or that translated into some other kind of movement, whether it was the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous or whether it was various mind-body therapies, they all rested on the idea that thinking is a spiritual experience, that your thoughts can bring you to some larger self-conception and can put you in the current of some flow of higher energies or the influence of a higher power that can make the difference in the life of an individual when willpower alone will not overcome an addiction or willpower alone will not reverse some crippling personal habit. The basic American spirituality is that your thoughts can make you an open channel for the entrance of some kind of current of higher influence that can make all the difference in your life. You find this in the 12 steps. You find this in the so-called power of positive thinking. You find this in the law of attraction. You find this in the ideas that ran through the movie The Secret. It's popularized in all kinds of different ways, and it's at the heart of our self-help and business motivational movements. It started as a very occult idea, and I really came to realize that the entire culture of occult and esoteric spirituality converged on that point. The idea that thoughts are causative is where all of the great experiments of alternative spirituality seem to converge and then grow popular under different names. So I came to feel that positive thinking was not just an influence on American culture, not just an artery among others, but was really a foundational part of who we are as modern individuals. That story, in many respects, is the backstory of America. So I wanted to dig deeper and write a full-scale history and analysis of where that idea came from and how powerful it's been. Now, the other side of the coin is, this is all very, very personal for me. You know, I was just thinking before we got on the phone this afternoon that I'm at a stage in my life where I'm 48 years old. I have been around the esoteric spiritual culture for a long time, experimented with many different paths and ideas, some of them very traditional, some of them would still be considered alternative or very far outside the mainstream, some would be considered esoteric. And I maintain this driven, deeply felt curiosity around every little pamphlet-sized book or every book that might seem to have a hokey-sounding title like The Science of Getting Rich or The Game of Life and How to Play It, or It Works, you name it. All these popularized little self-help books and pamphlets, they have this continual gravitational pull on me, and I continue to experiment with their ideas, even though many of my colleagues and contemporaries would think those ideas were unserious or were at least rendered in an unserious way in the popular literature. I love the popular literature because I feel there really is something there. And much of this literature grew out of the experience of American experimenters in the first half of the 20th century who didn't really have a big business apparatus at their back, but who had their own version of this positive thinking ideal that thoughts are causative. And they tried in their own ways and with what few resources they had to work out this idea, to experiment with this idea, and they produced an ocean of popular literature. And I believe that the notions, the concepts, the principles, the exercises that they were working with have tapped into something that we still fully don't understand. And as you alluded in your opening, the 21st century is going to start to seem more and more peculiar as time passes, as we learn more about the effects of mind-body therapies, placebo therapies, questions around quantum mechanics and the quantum measurement problem. These things are just not going to go away. The questions around them are going to deepen. And the first people who started asking those questions, sometimes in a slapdash way, sometimes in a sloppy way, were the pioneers of the positive thinking movement. And I find myself individually repeatedly drawn back to this literature again and again and again. And, you know, the background that I come from is such that you're supposed to be reading the classics of the spiritual traditions. And I do. But I tell you, I cannot get away from these little pamphlet-sized books that make these bold claims that serious people immediately want to dismiss. I can't dismiss them because I think they have a piece of the truth. So I'm driven both by a historical passion and a personal passion for these ideas.
Well, I really like the way that you. I mean, it's convenient almost that you fell in love with this stuff and that it keeps giving you, because it allows you access to a whole vein of what in some sense, and I think you'd probably agree, is the most important contribution of American religion to a larger world religion, mm-hmm. is precisely this idea that thoughts are causative, and that and one sign of this is that it's very American. And yeah. there's two things from what you said that pop up for that. One of those things is that it's very pragmatic. Mm-hmm. That we can, you know, go back to William James and talk about James's fascination with new thought, his profound conviction that there were actual psychological effects and powers that were being tapped, and that we needed to keep very, very open minds, even to squirrely ideas, because it was in that zone that we were going to find things that have actual effects in people's lives. And that was his great, you know, line on the pragmatic judgment of a belief system.
Yes, yes.
And that's profoundly American. But the other thing that people talk less about, that intellectuals talk less about, everyone recognizes pragmatism as an American kind of move, both in philosophy and you know, people debate these ideas today. There's still many pragmatists. But the other element is the popular culture, that this is a place where we see esoteric ideas that in the European context we would associate with small groups, inner circles, fraternal orders, mysterious ancient texts, Freemasonic lodges, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, that stuff's part of America, too. But also what's part of America, and this is why you don't use the word esoteric so much as occult, is this immense popular literature that's everywhere, that's in the dime store, that's in the, you know, that's just in these pamphlets, that's cheaply produced, that's available on the surface of American life. That's a very interesting and really under-acknowledged part of the story, is precisely the democratic, almost even kind of crass or simplistic surface. And yet there you are reading this going, oh, my God, look, that's out of Swedenborg. That's Hermeticism.
Yep.
That's Neoplatonism.
Yep. You're absolutely
exactly.
right.
Exactly.
It's,
you know?
It's the most extraordinary thing about this popular literature. It is so easy to dismiss, and it's so easy to say, oh, gee, that's hokey, and oh, man, I do not want to be seen on the subway reading a copy of The Mystic Path to Cosmic Power. But The Mystic Path to Cosmic Power, or, you know, choose your favorite title, is filled often with ideas that have a very deep family tree whose roots you were just alluding to, Hermeticism, Swedenborgian movement, some of the ideas that came from the occult healer Franz Anton Mesmer, Neoplatonism. Some of the most evocative religious experiments from human history found their nesting place in this popular literature. And William James, who you mentioned, he couldn't stop imbibing it. You know, he died in 1910, and he lived long enough to see the earliest flowering of this popular literature in America. And in his diaries and letters, he just could not get away from it. He and his wife, Alice, would imbibe this stuff, and he felt this deep conviction until his death that these popularizers who were around in his day, they had something, and we had to take the clay of what they were experimenting with and do our own experiments, that there was something deeply portentous there. And to some extent, we have taken up James's challenge, and we have embarked on those experiments, but in other ways, after his death, our culture shut down in a certain way that never really got fixed, that never got reopened, because the intellectual inquiry into these movements all but vanished.
Well, and let me ask you about this, Mitch, because this was something I felt is very important still to this day and so overlooked, and I think it's insane that it's overlooked, is that the divergence for me where the experiments began to happen and mm-hmm. where that kind of proof of these ideas can be seen came through the mesmerists
mm-hmm.
in the specific
right.
form of using those ideas to, it was anesthesia in surgery. Okay, what people don't realize,
yeah.
before they figured out ether and stuff like that, the mesmerists used those techniques, and people would have their bodies cut open with mm-hmm. steel, and they would not die. And nobody would die using these techniques, using surgery. And that feeds into what you were saying earlier with the placebo research and mm-hmm. things like that, is that I feel like that cutoff point where it turned into more philosophy and more of these, you know, ideals, it was going a direction of scientific experimentation through the magnetists, through the mesmerists, and it got totally chop blocked, and those ideas kind of halted in their tracks in the science department.
Yeah, that's very true. You know, I mean, Mesmer really was, and we're speaking of the Viennese healer Franz Anton Mesmer, who began to develop a reputation in Europe in the late 1770s. He would place people into what he called a magnetic trance, and he felt that by manipulating their so-called animal magnetism, this invisible ethereal fluid that Mesmer believed animated all of life, you could cure diseases and certainly place people into trance states and send them into these unusual mental states and such. What Mesmer actually did was he made the first modern discovery of what later came to be called the subconscious mind. His
yes.
the trance states that he put people in, the ability to create a kind of mental anesthesia, the magnetic trances, which later came to be called hypnotism, that he placed people into, the cures that people reported from his trance-based treatments. These opened the first modern window onto the existence of the subconscious mind, which really wouldn't even begin to get referred to until late in the 19th century, in the 1880s.
From Vienna again, right? It goes in like Vienna that brought us Mesmer, then Freud takes up the subconscious and is also in Vienna. It's so weird.
And Freud began his forays into the subconscious by experimenting with hypnotism. And
exactly.
Freud, who's very often seen as an ardent secularist, in fact, was very open to the question of whether in hypnotic states, whether in dream states, people experienced some sort of heightened abilities of clairvoyance or ESP. Freud was an early member of the Society for Psychical Research.
Yeah.
So none of our historical forebearers fit into these neat little boxes. You know, kids go to college and they come out of psychology 101 with their heads often filled with the idea that, you know, Freud was the guy who described, you know, religion as this anesthesia of the masses, and Freud was an ardent secularist and rationalist, and that's a partial truth. Freud was also very open to ideas that he inherited, at least indirectly, from figures like Mesmer. We lose a whole sense of our family tree in the West because we don't integrate these occult figures into it, and they're a fundamental part of it.
You know, the situation is even worse, as I'm sure you know, Mitch, the freshman coming out of Psychology 101, that barely hears the name of Freud. They'll mention Freud to discount it.
Right.
Many people in psychology
today, about the good old days, right?
Even the concept of the unconscious is heavily criticized because of its associations. And that's already a very secularized notion of the unconscious.
That's
and
a very good point. Yeah.
One of the things that I've that really clarified some of the issues here for me, I was actually just studying James again and looking at different historical accounts of how experimental psychology changed during his era and then what happened around the time of his death. And one of the I think the clearest way to see how these ideas were opened and then how they shut, at least in the mainstream or in the intellectual world, was that James had a very capacious model of the subconscious.
Mm-hmm.
He's basically saying things come out of this and we don't know where they come from.
Right, right.
And since we don't know where they come from, there's no reason to close the door.
Yes.
Right.
You know, he remained a skeptical person, but incredibly open-minded one. And so his idea of the subconscious even included the possibility that there could be other personalities, let's say, somehow inside there. Maybe they're... could they be spirits?
Right?
Possibly. But there's certainly... seems like other personalities who have their own stories, maybe their own languages, and there's all this incredible evidence that you pointed to in the 19th century that has all this crazy stuff. But then what happens, partly through Freud and his own, you know, resistance to some of these more capacious ideas, is that the unconscious becomes something individualized, located in your skull somewhere,
yes,
and disconnected from the very larger forces or possible sources of power that the New Thoughters are referring to.
Yes.
And so when James leaves the scene, the model of the subconscious, of where dreams come from, where intuitions come from, what was that sense that I was understanding someone else's, all of that stuff gets sort of shut down, and these days it's not even there as a category, so it's even worse. But
yes,
that really clarified it to me, because I'm like, I just go through a simple thought experiment in my head. I've read a lot of stuff. You've read a lot of stuff. Nobody knows what's going on yet.
Right.
Why would we close the door? Why would you close that door? You know, and I don't get it.
That is the shame of our intellectual life, and we suffered a blow when James died that we've never really recovered from. I mean, that James's work could have been boiled down to a single word, it would have been study. Study. You know, he just wanted us to look at things. You could create critical models for it. You could be skeptical. You could discontinue a line of inquiry, but don't close down the question. The problem with our intellectual culture today is we box off what questions can be asked and where they can be asked arbitrarily. We obviously have to make decisions. We have to make determinations about where to spend our resources, where to spend our own time, and we sometimes will go down a certain road, decide it's wrong, and turn around. Well, bravo. Let's keep doing that. But the problem is that James felt that a kind of guild or a club mentality had settled over all the professions in our nation, the medical profession, the psychological profession, the religious profession, and it boundaried off, just as you were describing in Freud's work, what could be studied, what questions could be raised. So the unconscious, for example, came to be seen as something that was a result of gray matter and not necessarily a phenomenon that could be open to all kinds of varying interpretations. Do we participate in some kind of shared thought patterns with other people? Is there some presence of clairvoyance? Is it heightened during a dream state? Is it heightened during hypnotism? Why do people from widely different backgrounds, geographies, places in time describe similar religious experiences? Are these things physically based? Are they psychologically based? Or is there some metaphysical possibility to the human experience that's recorded by people all across different times and places? James just wanted us to leave the door open on these questions and to pursue them rigorously, to pursue them with a great deal of intellectual muscle, but not to close the door. And in a sense, Freud's triumph is due to the shrewdness of his own realization, of his own diplomacy as an early 20th century figure. He wanted his theory of psychoanalysis to be seen as sitting ardently within the tradition of Western allopathic medicine. And he closed down his own youthful inquiries using hypnotism into questions of psychical research. And as you were saying, he boxed off the unconscious so that it seemed like a physical, kinetic, motor function. And his point of view won. And for several generations, psychoanalysis came to be seen as a medical science that you could put down and get paid for by your insurance carrier. I doubt that's the case anymore in the 21st century, but it certainly was for a couple of generations. And he made it seem as if the study of the mind was a study of a set of symptoms and psychomotor responses that we understood. And of course, we haven't begun to understand where any of these things come from any more than we did when James was alive.
Yeah, I have one real source of hope on this matter, which is, and it's probably because I was doing my own historical research into the 1970s. And in the 1970s, partly because of psychedelic drugs, there's this explosion of interest in altered states of consciousness. And this is happening among individuals who are reading and doing their own experiments. It's happening in laboratories. There's a whole zone of experimental psychology throughout the 70s where you have younger doctors who are open-minded because of their own relationships to the counterculture, to the emergence of the New Age or other kinds of ideas at that time. And they're also open. They're Jamesian. They're not sure what's going on here. And even if they're very scientific, there's a great sense of openness. And a lot of that research, fizzled out for a variety of reasons. That's a whole other story. But what came to me is that what stirs up these possibilities, especially in our culture now, is not so much new theories, new concepts, as new techniques, new ways of probing experience, of probing the edges of consciousness. And what we're on the lip of now is this whole world of consciousness hacking, of available, electromagnetic devices, neurostimulation, the resurgence of psychedelic research. And so even if the intellectual filters and the skeptics and the, that whole world are still, they're just going to keep on raging as long as they can, I believe that there's a whole new culture that we're just on the edge of people who are experimenting and exploring states of consciousness in an open manner that's going to revive and allow for a new assessment of these kinds of currents that currently are so pushed to the side, at least as far as mainstream world is concerned.
It's funny because that we had talked about that with Professor Wouter Honegraaff when he was on, just like what Mitch was talking about, how Freud chose to make it acceptable and accessible within the paradigm, right? So there's that. He kind of brought that up where it's like, well, if you don't do it in that acceptable manner, then you get, like, the doors closed, right? So he kind of saw and accepted, well, we're in this place where they're going to close the door to that, so how do I get around that closed door? But it's literally true where it was seen as a threat, like, to open those doors, to be that kind of Jamesian thinker. It was a threat to everybody else, because if we made those choices to explore those things, somehow the fabric of reality would be threatened by these dangerous ideas that just aren't true. But then, Eric, like you're saying, what's so funny is that even though the established paradigms and structures, like of science or whatever, are still there, the people instead are choosing to adapt those modalities. So it's made this, like, discrepancy. Eric, like you said, now there's all these, like, reality hackers, but then there's still the scientists that are not quite catching up with the reality hackers. So it's really interesting to see how those two are going to converge back again, kind of like how it was with the Mesmer stuff.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. And I think to help that along, and I use the term New Age in a positive sense. I mean, we're used to hearing that as an epithet, but to me, New Age is therapeutic spirituality, and I apply it to myself. I use it in a positive sense. Those of us who are on the New Age culture have to encourage a healthy intellectual climate in this culture, and that's something that we haven't seen for decades. The intellectual climate on the New Age culture is really poor. People are not interested in their family tree, their history, where they come from. I've told people, and I've made this point at several spiritual centers, you can become a lay student of quantum physics. If you can sit on a jury where you're deciding somebody's ultimate fate, you can become a lay student of quantum physics. You can learn about some of the placebo studies that are coming out of Harvard. You can learn about neuroplasticity. When we talk about these things, we should talk about them and have some understanding at our back. You know, I think the New Age culture, too, needs to participate more in the intellectual life of the country. Our organs and venues are pretty poor, you know, for the most part, and that's something that we can change.
Well, I think that's a good place to take a break. We'll look forward to talking more with Mitch in a moment. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maja Daou. And again, we're talking with Mitch Horowitz about the legacy of positive thinking in America, and we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Daou. We are talking with Eric Davis and Mitch Horowitz today about one simple idea and how positive thinking has been very formulative in America, whether you like it or not. So, I mean, let's think about that for a second, the opposing viewpoint. Because I am, you know, I grew up on the debate team, and if I feel like you, attracted to some of these ideas, I'm going to look at, well, why would they not be true? So I spend a lot of time looking at skeptics and, you know, reading material from folks that abhor this kind of material. Like the people, yeah, they make you feel embarrassed for being on the subway, reading your Master Cosmos book, like those people. And what I find is the biggest threat that this kind of William James type of open mentality seems to cause to people is that they don't want anarchy, right? They affiliate that kind of openness with disorder, with chaos, with evil even per se, because there's no structure. So it seems like the threat is that unknown itself, or being comfortable with the unknown. It's literally like they're rejecting the idea that you want to leave things open because it's dangerous. So that's where they close the doors to keep out the monsters or whatever.
Right.
So what would you say is like a good method for approaching that type of mentality? Or in your experience, because I'm sure you've had people maybe even approach you that way as a result of writing your book. I don't know. Or
sure,
just in
sometimes.
Your life.
You're raising a wonderful, wonderful point, and it's very important. I sort of engage in the same mental exercise. You know, I'm a big advocate of psychical research, ESP research, and in the book I write about one of my intellectual heroes, J.B. Rhine, the Duke scientist and researcher who really helped pioneer psychical research in this country in the late 20s, early 1930s and beyond. And that the research that Rhine and his inheritors did and continue to do is very, very, very important. It has attracted an just unbelievable wave of hostility and criticism that's not designed to win the debate so much as it is to shut down the debate. What I've often found among critics of psychical research is they don't want to have an argument and win. They don't want there to be an argument. I mean, they simply
yeah.
don't want there to be any funding for any kind of psychical research or any discussion of it. And they will even go after the placebo studies that are being done at Harvard Medical School right now. And they regard that yeah. as stuff that gets into the woo-woo frontier of disreputable pseudoscience. And it's very, very hard to have any kind of a constructive dialogue with them.
Well, and Mitch, I'll just add, you hit it. It's that they disrepute it. They
yeah.
don't look at the material. They completely ignore whatever they might be researching and only go in the direction of disrepute. So that's
right.
exactly correct. Yeah.
That's right. And they really don't want there to be a debate. You know, it's very hard to engage with somebody who doesn't want to win. They actually just don't want there to be a legitimate opposition of voices. And that is a very tight spot. And I often say to people, in my view, those guys have won. You know, those
yeah.
sort of ultimate critics have won, in the sense that anybody, any journalist who's writing a story about psychical research anywhere at any newspaper in this country, they will do a Google search on J.B. Rhine, and what they will find and what they will ultimately quote are the views of these critics. That's what they'll
right.
find their way to. They're media savvy, they're effective, they're
yeah.
good at sound
bites. Well, just to highlight one point, for particular
Please.
For our listeners who are interested in this kind of material, is one place that's exceptionally true is Wikipedia.
Yes.
But there is a very
totally.
There's a very self-defined
yep.
Policing kind of anti-woo force at Wikipedia
yep.
that forces even very
yep.
straight historical accounts
sure.
of religious or psychical claims into these convoluted, essentially sort of skeptical frameworks. And it's very,
Absolutely true.
Very, very unfortunate
yeah.
that this now extremely important source of information is fundamentally biased in this way. And I find this, and I'm just going to throw this out here because, I know you and we have a personal connection as well, is that in addition to all the arguments we could have, and I agree with you that effectively they have won much of the field,
mm-hmm.
I sometimes find this extremely depressing.
Yeah.
And it makes me angry, and then I get involved in this sort of anger mode and in arguing and
me
arguing
too.
Against something that I think is, you know, to speak pragmatically, probably a losing bet in a lot of zones. Not every place, and
mm-hmm.
there's always things to find, and maybe that's part of the answer, is to pay attention to those particular conversations that seem open. But I'm just curious how you navigate this, because you're a New York publisher,
mm-hmm,
you are
mm-hmm.
in the big world, you're not,
mm-hmm.
you know, just building your own little world of psychical interest.
Yeah.
You're engaged in this mainstream, you're writing for the New York Times, et cetera, et cetera. How have you, what kind of strategies, either in terms of your own personal, your own attitude, or intellectually, what kind of strategies have you found effective in sort of handling this, in some ways, very distressing situation?
Well, I appreciate that question very much. And one thing I decided years ago is that I was not going to run away from associations with the occult and the New Age. You know, I felt very strongly that by changing vocabulary terms, we don't make any new friends. And all we wind up doing is kind of participating in the debasement that people attach to those terms. So a lot of people who know me, you know, will recognize that I very freely describe myself as being part of the New Age culture. I describe the books that I publish and the subjects that I write on as being either New Age or occult or mystical. I very freely use terms like ESP. I'm happy to use terms like psychical research or psi research or precognition or whatever, but I always find those kind of whitewashings because, you know, disrepute has gotten attached to terms like ESP. I think we need to stand up and be very, very blunt about the terms and who we are and where we come from. When I speak of traditions like Wicca or neo-paganism, I will add very quickly that I regard these as entirely legitimate religious traditions, entirely legitimate systems of faith, communities of faith. I think we mustn't run away from those labels that people want to pin on us, because they're going to do it anyway. I suppose we could learn a little something from our friends over in hip-hop, who realized something about what you could do with epithets when, you know, people were going to sling them at you anyway. You may as well just, you know, use them. And I remember years ago when people used to ask me if I was publishing New Age books. You know, at first I would chafe at that, and, you know, I would feel like I had to come up with some sort of synonym or euphemism or something, and then I just realized, you know what, that's not going to change any minds. What you do is you stand up, you claim the label, you accept the label, and then you do your absolute best. And, you know, you take your hits. I mean, I've taken my hits. You know, sometimes I will receive a very, very good reception in a surprisingly mainstream place. Otherwise, I'll get a bad, sometimes I'll get a bad reception in a mainstream place because the person doesn't so much want to engage with my subject or with what I'm saying about the subject. They just want to review their general objection to the idea, for example, of ESP research being in the culture in general. And, you know, you're not necessarily going to avoid all those problems. But I think one thing that does help with the frustration and the anger that sometimes can very understandably come with being put into a box by these people is to accept the label on the box, because I think that I will always stand up in front of any audience anywhere and say, to me, New Age is a noble term. To me, New Age means therapeutic spirituality. It has very deep roots in this country. It's made a good difference in a lot of people's lives. I'm glad there are 12-step groups that dot this country. I like Stuart Smalley. I want to be associated with Stuart Smalley. And, you know, if anybody wants to make fun of that, you know, I will be happy to show them my membership card. So that's one of the ways I deal with it.
Well, I really like that attitude, too, because it reminds me earlier also of your exuberance for the very democratic, seemingly crass and cheap literature of positive thinking, particularly in the early 20th century, because the vibe that I keep getting from it, and I know you're a fan, you're the photograph in your new book, it shows you proudly wearing a Doors t-shirt.
I'm wearing that right now, actually, just by coincidence.
Yeah, it's a rock and roll attitude. It's like, look, I'm sorry, I think that like four teenagers in a garage in New Brunswick in 1965 can make far, far more powerful music than anything you're going to hear in the symphony hall this season.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of attitude has its sort of spiritual expression as well, which isn't about being anti-intellectual.
Right,
there's
plenty
of ways of talking about this stuff intellectually, but it's more about a kind of resonance with people, with the way that ordinary people try to make their way through the world. And you, as you know, I've been, you know, in my mid-career here in a PhD program.
Yeah.
And I mean, I knew this going in, and yet it is still the case that I was and remain shocked at the a number of not scientists, not neuroscientists, not cognitive scientists, not people who have devoted their lives to these, you know, in some ways reductionist disciplines, which I have enormous respect for, but rather these sort of social sciences, scientists, historians, cultural theorists, humanities people.
Yeah.
90% of them are even worse than the scientists in terms of the speed with which they reach for a snarky tone, a reductionist argument. I mean, I know I'm kind of getting cranky here, but
well, you're in it.
My mind a lot, and it's just very, very, very enervating. So rather than continuing the cranky line, I wanted to turn it back to you and just ask, especially in your last chapter where you look at sciences that these people should be paying attention to.
Yeah.
Discussions of neuroplasticity, the ongoing enigma of the placebo effect.
Yeah.
And let's talk a little bit about that and how you see these researchers sort of tentatively and carefully supporting some aspects of the whole mind cure zone.
Well, neuroplasticity is an interesting case. You know, that's a therapy that involves consciously redirecting your thoughts. And researchers have found that when dealing with maladies like obsessive-compulsive disorder, for example, the consistent redirection of thoughts will actually alter the physical neural pathways in your brain, so that we are seeing literally, repeatedly, verifiably through brain scans that if a person suffers from OCD, he or she has certain identifiable neural pathways through which electrical impulses travel. If that individual can follow a sustained program of redirecting his or her thoughts, those physical neural pathways will change. So we're literally seeing an instance where our thoughts are resulting in a measurable, identifiable physical change. And that's extraordinary. And nobody is questioning this data. And I'll tell you, the very same insights, sometimes using remarkably similar language, were articulated by people in the positive thinking movement in the early 20th century. They didn't have, obviously, the benefit of brain scans or a bio-neuro language, but they would talk about changing your thoughts, altering your thought grooves, redirecting your thoughts. This same vocabulary is used by some of the researchers today who are documenting neuroplasticity. So that's just one area where we are, as a culture, as a community, as people who are sometimes seeking therapy or cure for a malady, whether it's addiction or OCD, we're accepting a thesis that was promulgated by the positive thinking people over a century ago. And it's extraordinary, because if it holds
It's true, and it goes back even farther than that. I mean, just to add to it, right, when you trace back the origins, like through the history, even we can go back as far as Mesmer, but then Mesmer gets his information from the alchemists and from Paracelsus. So this is that concept, that mind and training your thoughts, is, like you said at the beginning of the show, the one idea that is so huge and so gigantic that, yes, all these little branches stem off of it, but ultimately it always returns to that ancient occult Gnostic thing that you can somehow, we can tame this animal, right? Domesticate our urges, our subconscious urges that seem to drive us to do all these dumb stuff, but somehow through using our brain that we can evolve as human beings, which doesn't seem like that weird of an idea. And why would people have a weird reaction to that? Don't understand. You know, it's so shocking, but that's it. That's really it right there that you come down to. This is a really old idea, and why not explore it further when we see such things that they're finding in scientific research?
And, you know, this actually brings us back to a point that you were raising earlier, which is trying, and Eric, forgive me, I don't want to, you know, reopen the can of whoop-ass here, but I'm going to go back to the critics for a moment. Trying to understand why it is that people find those ideas so threatening is an interesting mental exercise. And part of the reason is, and I'm not unsympathetic to it, that there are people who fear, and this has been true for decades, ever since J.B. Ryan started his research at Duke, that this stuff is going to trickle out to the culture, and you're going to have people saying, hey, according to Harvard, my illness is all in my mind, or according to Duke University, you know, I can use my thoughts to alter my teenager's behavior. And they're worried, the critics, that this is going to open up a door to some new wave of, as you were saying, anarchy or some sort of, you know, just pell-mell, helter-skelter wave of irrationality. And I understand where they're coming from. I can relate to their fears and concerns, because our culture, especially this mass consumerist culture that we live in, will take ideas and reprocess them in such a way that they'll be almost unrecognizable 15 minutes after they were first brought to public attention. And I understand that, but that can't become an excuse for shutting down debate, you know. And it comes back to William James again, you know, this, all this can happen, all this experimentation, all this questioning, it just needs to be done with a sustained intellectual muscularity.
It's so funny you were saying this, because I was just writing a response to someone who was criticizing William James and the role that he plays in religious studies in particular, and he was saying that one of the reasons that James should be retired is because his ideas have the potential to be misused in a vulgar way. And I was like, wow, that is such a weird argument. And what was particularly weird about it is that he used the word vulgar.
Right.
And when I think about forms of complex intellectual thinking that have been widely abused, even yes. in a historical way, horrifically abused, I think of vulgar materialism
yeah.
and vulgar Marxism, which
yeah.
are, and I'm like, such a weird thing that he would refer to precisely the term that indicates how the other side is guilty of the same potential, and that doesn't stop them.
Yeah.
It doesn't stop them that the production of scientific knowledge or technical capacity without a value structure can just radiate through the market and produce nihilistic responses,
mm-hmm.
People's meaningless lives, there's no point, we're just meat machines. That's fine.
Right.
But if the concept has some potential of creating a context of meaning, even if we understand that existentially and not ontologically, oh, no, that's terribly dangerous. People might
yeah.
feel better or not think that we're just meat machines or something.
Yeah, yeah. Well, again, the we're going through a period right now in American life, and this has been true probably for the past 30 years or so, where academia is held in very poor repute. The term professor is like an epithet as used on the Fox News network. As soon as someone utters professor, it's like, oh, here come the woolly-headed, pointy-headed guys again who are going to misdirect our energies and our liberties. Academia is held in poor repute, and it's partly because of things like what your friend did. People are made to feel that these writings, whether they come out of William James or whether they come out of the Transcendentalists, are somehow not fit for public consumption, that they're not fit for the non-professional to read and to imbibe. Several years ago here, I published a small collection of Emerson's essays with an introduction by Jacob Needleman. And there was some academic newsletter somewhere that trashed it, and I got into an exchange with the editor of the newsletter, and the reviewer was complaining, and he actually literally made this point, which I paraphrase faithfully, that the problem with the anthology was that it had very little historical background, and it was impossible to read and understand Emerson without historical background, which
wow.
runs contrary to exactly how Emerson saw himself. He would no sooner give a speech than he would issue that speech as a pamphlet. He produced his writings to be read. He felt they were for every curious man or woman, in the same way that Mozart would very forthrightly state that his operas were intended to entertain. And to create that kind of barrier to the individual entering a work, whether it's a piece of music or a piece of writing or whether it's William James, it's so antithetical to the intention of the artist, him or herself. This whole idea that you need to plow through a 90-page introduction in a Penguin Classics edition before you can read Frankenstein is just antithetical to our best educational traditions. That's one of the reasons why academia is held in poor repute in the popular culture today. Yes, there's an anti-intellectual streak in American culture. That's been true for a long time. But in the same way that New Agers have to take some of the responsibility for why some of our ideas get run down, academia has to take some responsibility for why it's held in poor repute in the popular culture today. And that's thanks to the kinds of activities that you were just describing on the part of your friend.
Wow. Well,
we
only have a couple of minutes left here, and I did want to mention one of the ideas I walked away from your book that was the most helpful for me, is a gentle corrective you offer to the positive thinking side, to the mind cure side, that the problem with that we see with so much some new age thinking is just how excessive it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's that there's one answer, and the answer
yeah.
is that mind creates reality. And it's so simplistic. But on the other hand, a much more multidimensional view of reality, where there are all sorts of forces, historical forces, cosmic
yep.
forces, physical forces, biological forces, psychological forces, and there is still the force of the mind.
Yes, that's my view. Yeah. We live under many laws and forces, and one of them involves the mind, and it puts us in front of a forest, a very deep forest, of questions about its uses, its possibilities, its influences, its causative properties, which we can see, for example, in neuroplasticity. What is it? We don't know. We have to fall to our knees in front of that question. We have to keep studying. We have to keep experimenting. But we shouldn't make that leap, as you were just alluding, to the idea that we live under one mental super law. There are all kinds of laws and forces that we live under, of which the mind is one extraordinary one among others, and we should probe the dimensions of that extraordinary force.
That's words to live by. Mitch, thanks so much for this. Do you have a site online where people can go and find out more about what you're doing?
My name, MitchHorowitz.com. If you throw my name into Google, you will not be able to get rid of me. You will have no trouble finding me.
Good stuff. Good stuff. Well, thank you so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Thank you, guys. I really enjoyed it.
Great. Well, from me and Majid, all you out there, keep your minds open.